This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio, 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean County and Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, 97.1 in Lincoln, 89.1 in DeKalb Sycamore, 89.3 in Morris Joliet, covering much of central and northern Illinois, and we're growing thanks to you. We're going to have a great show for you today. Of course, we've been gone for the last couple of weeks. I hope everybody out there had a happy Memorial Day weekend. We certainly did. It was beautiful weather, and couldn't be better, nice and dry. And, of course, we do need a little bit of rain, but it was nice to have it dry and sunny for the Memorial Day weekend, and we got out and did some visiting and some traveling and some picnicking, and so we were gone, of course, for that day. And then, of course, we were gone last week again, too. We had some company coming in from out of state, and we're doing a lot of things on that weekend. A little bit warmer last weekend, but nevertheless, it was still dry again. It wasn't humid, and it was sunny, so it made for a very nice weekend. I'm here with my wife, Lynn, and as I said, we'll have a great show for you today. Before we start, I'll turn this over to my wife, Lynn, ask her if she wants to say anything or any topics in mind. So, Lynn, go ahead.
Hi, good to be back with you. I hope you're happy to have us back. We're worn out. You know, when you get older and you wait for the kids to come and you're so happy to see them all. But by the end of the week, we've been so busy with the grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And the great-grandchildren, you know, are range from 14 to 6 months. So it's been run, run, run. And do, do, do. We even managed to buy, not us buy, but even managed to find a wedding gown in Dunlap, the bridal shop for my one granddaughter who's getting married in September. And it's just been crazy, crazy week. Now I'm looking at Saturday morning and got up and I thought, this house is a mess. But after Monday, my daughter's going back to Texas and we'll get back into a routine. Then I'll be sitting there thinking, why are they all so darn far away? Well, this week, as far as the church goes, the Feast of Corpus Christi was June 8th, and that's the feast that we celebrate the body and blood of Christ. It's Christ's presence with the church for all eternity. He's with us in his, the complete. He is there. He is with us. He left that for us. A part of him is here. Well, in the United States, it's not celebrated on Thursday anymore. It's celebrated on this coming tomorrow, or the Sunday. So it's the Feast of Corpus Christi. And they're bringing back the processions. They used to have them all the time. I can remember being in them. It was a good place to wear your first communion dress, you know, and carry flowers and go in procession ahead of the priest with the monstrance. It was a beautiful procession. It's something we had lost for a while, but it's coming back, having the processions. It's a beautiful celebration for everybody. Also, we had the first mass, the ordination first mass of Nathan Hooper, and he is now one of the four new priests ordained for the Diocese of Peoria, and we're so blessed to have four new priests. We sure need priests, and we need to be praying for vocations. Many parishes, the smaller parishes, you know, have been closed down and will be more in the coming years because of the lack of priests. You know, we don't live forever, so the priests we have are getting older, and we need some younger blood in here. So pray for them. But Nathan's first Mass was just beautiful. Just beautiful. So is the ordination, if anybody got to go. I guess they had an overflow of over 200 people for the ordination, and they had to go to the Spalding Center, which is next to the cathedral, and watch it on TV. But it's a beautiful thing, and it's a beautiful season for the church. So, happy Corpus Christi. Remember that the body and blood of Christ is with us, truly present after the consecration and the Mass. And we need to be respectful of that. Okay, Bob.
Okay, very good. And again, you're right. We sure need more priests, and we need to pray for more vocations. The world, we don't only need it, the world needs it. I noticed that on my list here that I have forgotten to talk about donations, and I always do on the beginning of every show, so I'll mention that again. We're brought to you, as you know, by you, and we wouldn't be brought to you without you, and we couldn't be brought to you if it wasn't for your donations. So again, any donations that you can give are always appreciated, and if you'd like to make a donation, go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And it'll tell you there more about us. It'll also tell you how to make a donation. And we would appreciate it much if you want to call us. You can also call us at 309-807-2427. Again, that's 309-807-2427. But it's best if you can go to our website. You'll find out more information there on how to make a donation. And one of the themes I said that, I shouldn't say one of the themes, but the theme that Lynn and I have chosen for this year is the theme that it's a mad, 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 mad world out there. And I think people can see from what's been going on over the last few days, more madness in this world and that's going on. And I think the show today, what we're going to talk about, may show a little bit about why that madness is going on. We've touched on it before. But I want to do an article from Chronicles Magazine, and it's about the social contract theory. It's called Social Contract Theory as Feathered Serpent, How Enlightenment Thinkers Created a Mythology for the Modern World. And it's by Douglas Wilson, and Douglas Wilson is a Reformed Presbyterian minister and a professor at New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho, and he's the author of numerous books recently included, a number of things at any rate, and he's got a good article here. It's very interesting. And I think it'll shed a lot of light, maybe some light that he doesn't even realize that he's shedding on what's happening in the world today. And before we start, I want to point out, you know, what we mean by social contract theory. Now, the whole idea of social contract theory, the Enlightenment social contract theory, is a theory explaining how the state got started. And it's attributed a lot to Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and some of the other philosophers of the so-called Enlightenment. And I use that word so-called Enlightenment because probably we could really picture it as the Endarkenment, that is the moving away from religion into pure materialism. And a lot of that movement away from religion into materialism and the invention of these social contract theories and so forth and everything have led right up to the place that we're at now. I've mentioned this before and talked about it before. And this article, I think, brings it home a little bit better again. But the whole idea in the Enlightenment idea was how the state came about was that prior, according to Thomas Hobbes, to the modern state, the primitive times were just groups of solitary individuals in search of food. You know, all these individuals were walking around through the jungle or the savannas or the hills and valleys and forests and lakes and so forth, looking for food. And you can probably picture them as they walked around with a club sort of like a baseball bat slung over their shoulder. And whatever they would come across, they could take out of nature. That is, the, you know, hit the rabbit over the head and take it for themselves, or knock the apple off the tree or the banana off the tree or whatever it happened to be, and take it out of nature, keep it for themselves, and then make it for themselves. And each person, of course, was a total law unto himself, totally free to live and do as he wished or she wished. And it sounds great out in this natural world doing all of that. But there was one little flaw, and that was that some people could understand that some providers and seekers of food were better providers and seekers than others. And instead of going out and batting their own banana off the tree or knocking their own apple off the tree or hitting their own rabbit over the head, they could sneak up on somebody else, hit them over the head, and take their food. And so in this paradise of everybody being free, walking around, taking everything out of state of nature, there was the flaw of you had to have eyes in the back of your head.
Because the nuns had them, that taught us.
Right. Maybe that, you know, you sort of had to have these eyes in the back of your head because somebody could always be creeping up on you. And, of course, not only somebody else, but also maybe the very prey that you were hunting might be behind you, creeping up on you and hunting you. So things weren't quite as happy and as rustic and as nice in that primitive world as they might seem. And so the whole idea of the Enlightenment period is that these people began to be anxious about walking around, wondering who was behind them or what was behind them ready to strike. And it might be a good idea if they could appoint certain people to protect them as they walked around. And so this is what they did. They came together and they formed a social contract. And that's where the social contract theory comes from. They formed a social contract with everybody else that a certain group of people would be the guardians, and they would guard you as you walked around through nature in search of food, looking for something to bonk over the head or looking for an apple to knock off the tree. And you wouldn't have to worry then about someone or something sneaking up on you, banging you over the head, or maybe eating you. And that's how the state came into existence. And for some reason, it's not explained, once this social contract was made, at least according to Thomas Hobbes at the time, you could never take it back somehow or another. Once you agreed to this theory, and it's not explained exactly why that is, that the state came into existence and now the state was permanent and you could never take it back. And of course, if you're going to have these people whose full-time job is to protect you, then they need to eat and so forth too. So you have to take part of whatever you are able to take out of nature and make your own and give it to them. And so they're entitled then to a certain percentage of the various food and so forth that you get, and that is called taxation. And you know, the whole path right back, you know, to Birmingham leads from, you know, the primitive jungle and the social contract theory right up to modern society. So that's what the social contract theory is. And the article here is talking about the social contract theory as a feathered serpent, meaning that many different tribes have social contract theories. And so I'll just start reading from the article, and we'll see what Douglas Wilson has to say about the social contract theory as a feathered serpent. Is there anything you want to add before I start?
No, I think it's going to be a good topic.
Okay. It's
very, talk about a mad, mad world.
It's very interesting. You're right. It was a mad, mad world, and the state is supposed to undo and unravel that mad, mad world. But there's some things that, you know, people have to have when they come together as a state and they have such a social contract theory as that. And when you don't have those things any longer, bad things happen. And that's what we're looking at, some of those bad things happening today. So let's read. It says here, there are many things I appreciate. Doug Wilson here is writing the article, and he's writing it in the first person, saying, there are many things I appreciate about Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed. But while Deneen's study orbited around its topic and examined it in great detail, it never actually achieved escape velocity. Deneen's book showed all the ways in which he thought classical liberalism had formed and shaped the world, against which he certainly wished to rebel. But in his conclusion, he acknowledged all the achievements of classical liberalism that he still wanted to keep and maintain. Women's rights, for example, is one of the things that he said that he wanted to keep and maintain, as if somehow or another women's rights are somehow different, you know, from human rights in general. And he goes on here, Wilson. He says, like a very young boy running away from home, he, Deneen, reconsidered when he reached the end of the driveway. And I think I remember it used to be a lot of fun. Remember your sister, Lynn, when she used to
I'm just thinking of that. Right. She'd run away from home on her bicycle. She'd get angry. She couldn't cross the street.
She'd walk the bike a lot of times. I lived about two blocks away from my wife at the time, Lynn, and she had a sister that was about 7 years younger than her. And, of course, I wasn't even going with Lynn at that time. But nevertheless, we knew both Lynn and Annie, her sister. And we used to be sitting on our front porch a lot of times, and here would come Annie with her bicycle going down the sidewalk, and we'd say, where are you going, Annie? And I'm running away from home. She would tell us.
She was going to go to my grandmother's.
Right. Yeah, right.
But she couldn't cross the street.
That's what we'd say. You're going to your grandmother's, Annie? Yeah, I'm going to my grandmother's. Okay, be careful. She'd get down to the corner from our block, you know, about a half a block away from us. Go out to it was the main street there.
And it was right on Route 6.
Yeah, she would stop there.
Went right through town.
And pretty soon here she'd come walking back, usually walking the bike back.
Crying.
Yeah, and say, I can't cross the street. I can't run away from my dad and say, well, here, Annie, I go in the house. I'm going to get you a candy bar and you'll feel better. And he'd give her a candy bar and back up the street she'd go.
Yeah.
And it sounds the same thing here with this Patrick Deneen. He wants to run away from liberalism, and he can't get past the end of the driveway because he suddenly starts realizing that there are certain things about liberalism that he wants to keep.
Yeah.
So at any rate, it was the same thing with Annie. She started thinking of all the things that she was missing from home, you know, and she wanted to keep, and back she'd go. So at any rate, we're going to stop here and take a break, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio.
It was wonderful to pray with our Catholic Spirit Radio listeners and watch the powerful movie at last week's Outdoor Rosary and Movie event. A big thanks to Tate's Old Fashioned Ice Cream in LaGrange, Illinois, which created and donated a special ice cream treat for all of us. Did some of you not hear about this event? When we have special events or news, we use email addresses to tell our listeners first. Do we have yours? If not, email us so you don't miss the next event. office@catholicspiritradio.com.
Hi, this is Kathy
and Ann
from Catholic Spirit Radio. We are looking for folks who would love to volunteer with us during our fundraisers and various other station events and tasks throughout the year.
We really need volunteers in the DeKalb, Sycamore, Morris, Joliet, and Lincoln areas, as well as Bloomington Normal.
If you have a few extra hours or more a month, put them to use for the Lord.
We would love to add your name to our Catholic Spirit Radio volunteer list. Contact us at office@catholicspiritradio.org.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. And we're talking about social contract theory as a feathered serpent written by Douglas Wilson. And I've been reading from that, and so we'll continue. He goes on talking about the fact that Patrick Deneen wants to rebel against liberalism, explaining why liberalism failed. And he doesn't really get off the ground or very far in this article when he starts realizing there are certain things about liberalism he wants to keep. And Wilson says, despite this failure by Deneen, the book still made a significant contribution, one that I appreciated very much, which goes to show yet again how every dark cloud has a silver lining. Deneen reminded me of something I always love to be reminded of, which is how much I hate social contract theory. His book also revealed, at least to me, the space that social contract theory has come to occupy in our political thinking. It is actually an origins myth, and it really is. I mean, it's when you think about it, it's a myth that sort of explains, you know, how our society came into existence, and maybe to a certain extent, you know, how we came into existence as groups and people and so forth. It says, every tribe has an origins mythology. The Babylonians have their Enuma Elis, in which the god Marduk finally subdued the forces of chaos. The Cherokee believed that all animals were up in heaven, but it got too crowded there. The earth was covered with water, so the animals sent down a water beetle who pulled up mud from the bottom of the sea to create the land, and then the wings of a great buzzard formed the mountains and valleys. Among the Mayans, seven deities, including the feathered serpent, Kukulcan, formed human beings out of white and yellow corn. So these are some of the origins myths. And, you know, however outlandish such stories might seem to us, and they are outlandish, they nevertheless present us with answers to the very pressing questions that every social group must ask. Who are we? How did we get here? And where are we supposed to be going? And if you stop and think about it, if you think about the creation myth of the Bible, and when I use the word myth here, I'm talking about story, explanation. When we say myth, we don't necessarily mean something that's untrue. We mean something that is a storied explanation of how things came to be. And so when we think of the biblical myth compared to some of these other primitive and pagan type stories, the biblical story is actually pretty scientific, really, when you think about it. The biblical story talks about a void, that is, you know, a time when there was nothing but, you know, space or darkness, and it was over the face of the deep. And then we, you know, talk about water, which is a life-giving thing. And then the biblical myth talks about the spirit over the water, and spirit being some type of creative force, God, whatever, over the water. And land, you know, came into being, and the land was divided from the water, and then sun came into being, and the moon came into being, and there was a day. I mean, it follows really a lot of what we know today scientifically, you know, the moon, the sun, the stars. It does talk about the stars in the biblical myth also, you know, the heavens above and the spheres and so forth of the heavens. And then it goes on and talks about how after all of this was made, the water and the earth and so forth, then the animals started to appear, the fish first, and then the animals on the land. And isn't this scientifically how really our science explains how the earth was created? It was a ball of gases and dust and so forth that coalesced in space, in the darkness of space, and it coalesced into water and land. And then through a type of evolution, animals, you know, came into existence. First, the water-type animals, tiny creatures in the water and so forth, and then fish, and then finally animals on land, and then finally man and so forth. So if we look and compare the biblical myth to some of the other myths, I just wanted to point this out. It is very, very scientific, very, very good explanation, really, of how the Earth came into existence. And it would be a good explanation for people who are not yet scientifically minded and don't understand the science that we do today. And so at any rate, this is what the creation myths are for in even primitive tribes, to answer those questions. Who are we? How do we get here? And where are we supposed to be going? And then the most important questions of all, how are we supposed to behave on the way? And that's one of the most important questions. He goes on, he says, as my son N.D. Wilson wrote in Notes from the Tilt-A-Whirl, every culture has felt the overwhelming pressure of existence itself and the need to explain it. There's a sort of nervousness apparent in the myths of every people's group, as if maybe we're not supposed to be here, and we all have to rehearse our story before the authorities come. We're sorry, there was this ice giant, we explain. And then we say, when Pengu died, we had nowhere else to go, we tell the cop. It's as if somehow or another, when we give these explanations, we have to account for ourselves somehow to somebody as to why exactly it is that we're here and, you know, why we're trespassing on this property, I guess. It goes, it says, as it happens, social contract theory has performed precisely the same mythological function for moderns. Hasn't it really, when you think about it, this idea that's sort of ridiculous that we're all wandering around in the jungle in search of food, and so we came together and formed the social contract in order to protect ourselves so that we could be a little bit more secure in our lives. It says, the ancient examples are defined by us as outlandish for various reasons, but right at the center of those reasons is the glaring fact that they are all plainly superstitious legends. They didn't actually happen. We think, and for good reason, that these myths should be relegated to the realm of retired superstitions because they did not actually occur. Who really believes that a feathered serpent ever did anything? But the problem that confronts us in our vaunted superiority is the fact that the social contract never happened either. The whole thing is a thought experiment that somehow created obligations for everybody. This is a parliament that never met, voting on a bill that was never drafted, but only after serious debate among members who were never born. The outcome of all these invisible civic forces moving about is that we, out here in the real world, are somehow under a solemn obligation to the state, which must not be questioned. In other words, the Enlightenment theory explains the state, and somehow we dare not question it. But when you think about it, it's just as unlikely that it happened, and it certainly didn't happen any more than any of the feathered serpent theories that explain how other people came into existence. This is the logic of idolatry, which is capable of creating any species of feathered serpent to fill the void. The void exists because as humans, we need a foundation for our society. It is deep within our created nature. And the fact is that we need a religion to explain not only how we got here, but so that we can explain what the law is. What is good, what is bad, what is right, what is wrong, what is permitted, and what is not permitted. And every civilization, if it's going to remain a civilization, it needs that, and it needs an agreement on something like that, or there is no unity and the people can't get along, and that's exactly what we're sort of aiming at right now when we take a look at our society. How did it get the way that it is today when none of us can seem to agree on anything and our culture is deconstructing and falling apart? Goes on. It said the feathered serpent of social contract theory was born during the Enlightenment, the so-called Enlightenment, again, I say. despite the fact that we all were already under a genuine social contract that actually did happen in history. God created and appointed two representatives of the entire human race, our first parents, and placed them in the garden. And look at that word, parents. In other words, the real theory of how we came together as people is the fact that our society and any society really is built on families, parents, children, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, and so forth. And these were formed and then formed into tribes and clans and so on, and finally into nations. And this is the more reasonable explanation of how the state came into existence. And God, he placed them in the garden, and God then told them that they must not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This was not a tree that would provide our first parents with a basic understanding of morality. For if that is what it gave, then they could not have sinned by eating from it. They could do no wrong by eating from the tree if they approached it without any understanding of right and wrong in the first place. In other words, they were told that it was wrong to eat from the tree. They had to understand right and wrong before they could be told that something was wrong. Rather, throughout the Old Testament, knowledge of good and evil refers to the maturity and wisdom required by rulers, judges, and kings. Our first parents sinned by grabbing for such rulership prematurely. They were under an actual social covenant with God, but they wanted another one with different terms. In other words, they wanted more freedom for themselves, and they wanted more power for themselves. They didn't want to be under the contract that God gave them. Their sin was to assume the prerogatives of rule for themselves, establishing their authority on their own terms and in their own name. Sound pretty much like what we hear constantly today, I want things my way. This is precisely the thing that Enlightenment social contract theory seeks to do as well. In other words, the whole theory, this whole theory, social contract theory, which is just as silly in the long run as some of these other creation myths, was designed for one thing, so that we could get away from the creation myth of the Bible and get away from the Bible itself and get away from God itself and somehow create and construct our own secular society. It's actually an explanation of secularism coming into existence. And if we want to take a look around at our society today, we're looking at secularism separated from Christianity, separated from God, going out of existence just about as quickly as it came into existence. Every human society is a moral organism, and this means that every human society must make decisions that have a moral component. It therefore follows that every human society must give an account of the decisions it makes, not to mention the morality upon which those decisions rest. We are just now starting to realize how bankrupt the mythology of secular classical liberalism, that is, the whole social contract idea, is. Which is why someone like Dineen can cause quite a stir by pretending to challenge it. We are perhaps starting to realize that our feathered serpent is just like all the other feathered serpents, the so-called scientific materialistic explanation of how the world came into existence and how the state came into existence and so forth is no more than a primitive pagan feathered serpent that really doesn't do much for us once the veneer of Christianity wears off. Instead of an Enlightenment myth, we need a primal covenant that actually was made and understood by individuals who truly represented us and represented us well. And there's a huge difference between a covenant and a contract. A covenant is when we belong to each other. A contract is some kind of a rule and agreed upon by each other and refereed by an outside body of other people. But we also have something else to deal with. We cannot appeal to the reality of this paradise without also remembering that paradise was lost to us. There was the garden, but there was also the expulsion from the garden. This means we must also remember our fallen nature. We have a social contract, but because of our sinful rebellion, that contract has been rashly broken, and it was the whole social contract theory that broke it. The whole idea during the Enlightenment period, during the 18th century, and actually prior to that, back in the 16th century, when Martin Luther began to break up the oneness of Christendom and the Catholic Church. And when that happened, we lost the real contract theory that we had in the real religion, in the real idea that held us together. Our created nature calls out for a societal foundation. Our fallen nature does not want that foundation to be the Word of God. The fact that we spurn the Word that fashioned all the worlds, does not grant us the authority or ability to come up with our own mythical constructs. But we tried anyway. I am convinced that the reason social contract theory has had such staying power is because we instinctively realize that our only alternative is found in Genesis. And some of us fear that leaves us looking like fundamentalists or naive little Sunday school kids. In other words, somehow or another, we have to be more mature. We have to construct something more scientific, and we come up with the so-called scientific social contract theory that when you really carefully look at it, not only is just as silly as all the other feather serpents, but when we take a look at what our world is doing today, falling apart, we know that it's not working. So what happened was this. The 17th and 18th century Enlightenment social contract theorists, all of those poobahs, you know, and bigwigs, Rousseau, Hobbes, Locke, all of those were men who were writing in the centuries just before Darwin. So we're going to stop here and take a break. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio.
It was wonderful to pray with our Catholic Spirit Radio listeners and watch the powerful movie at last week's Outdoor Rosary and Movie event. A big thanks to Tate's Old Fashioned Ice Cream in LaGrange, Illinois, which created and donated a special ice cream treat for all of us. Did some of you not hear about this event? When we have special events or news, we use email addresses to tell our listeners first. Do we have yours? If not, email us so you don't miss the next event. office@catholicspiritradio.com.
Help seniors remain independent. Faith in Action is a nonprofit providing transportation for people over 60 to medical appointments and grocery stores. Become a Faith in Action driver in the extended Bloomington Normal area, 309-827-7780.
Listeners support Catholic Spirit Radio in many different ways. Some write checks, others use credit cards. But did you know that you can also give Catholic Spirit Radio your old car, truck, boat, motorcycle, or RV, even if it's not working? Donating your vehicle is easy. We take care of everything from pickup to tax receipt. Just go to CatholicSpiritRadio.com to click on the Donate Your Vehicle link. Or call 866-628-CARS.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. We're talking about an article here written by Douglas Wilson, a Presbyterian minister, about the social contract theory. And reading from that article, and we're talking about how the Enlightenment occurred in the centuries just before Darwin, talking about the social contract theory. and the Enlightenment thinkers who were talking about all of these things were doing that just before Darwin. They could not have known that they were paving the way for him, but they most certainly were. The relics of the first Christendom still had an operational origin story. For the Enlightenment thinkers, a replacement was an absolute necessity. In other words, we have got to get rid of all of this old-fashioned biblical stuff and its belief in God and so forth and start basing everything on good old solid materialism of the secular world. And again, I'm pointing out and take a look around you today, and this is what we're seeing, the final end of what the Enlightenment thinkers started. It goes on here, it says, for the Enlightenment thinkers, a replacement was an absolute necessity, and social contract theory was that perfect substitute. It met all the requirements. No God, no transcendence, and it never actually happened, making it impervious to historical investigation. What could be better? The vote that occurred in this evanescent parliament was not subject to any demand for a recount. No scandal could bring this government down. A vote of no confidence was not possible because this was an ideal voting system for totalitarians, one in which no voting actually took place. And isn't that exactly what seems to be happening today? We seem to be descending into totalitarianism all the time as we're descending, screaming, democracy, democracy, democracy. And the more we scream democracy, it seems the more totalitarian we get. And as a consequence, a functionally atheistic society now had a philosophical basis for societal cohesion that the big thinkers could point to. And upon the publication date of Darwin's Origin of Species, the rapid acceptance of the theory of evolution meant that the Judeo-Christian origin story underpinning Western civilization, along with the societal cohesion that it provided, had finally gone the way of the whistling wind. And to these thinkers, goodbye. We're going to the new golden world now that we are creating ourselves. We set up these golden calves at Dan and Bethel, and the lies worked for a time, but only for a time. As mentioned earlier, the basic questions are these. Who are we? How did we get here? And where are we supposed to be going? Followed naturally by the very practical question, how are we supposed to behave on the way? If we reason from raw Darwinism alone, the answers to the first three questions appear to be as follows. Who are we? We are a chance collection of meat and bones and protoplasm. How did we get here? We evolved through blind processes of time and chance, grinding away on matter. And where are we going? Nowhere in particular. There's just one damn thing after another.
It's true.
All of these answers put an even greater weight on that last question, how are we supposed to behave? And if you take a look at the world around us today, is the answer seems to be more and more and more, we don't know.
And we don't care.
And maybe you're right, we don't care. The challenge of the last questions for post-Darwinian moderns is that the meaninglessness of a Darwinian cosmos cannot be turned by some magic trick into a place where societies with meaning and purpose can thrive. If something is meaningless and English language has any meaning at all, meaningless means meaningless. I'll never forget. Remember, Lynn, the time that we were going, it was 4th of July, and we were going to march in the 4th of July parade with a group of people, and one of the members of the group and I were talking, and this guy was an atheist, and he said, we, you know, live in this meaningless universe, you know, that everything was just created by blind chance. He's talking about Darwinism and so forth. We were waiting to get formed up, and we had a lot of time on our hands just sort of standing around. And then he says, that's why we have to give meaning and purpose to our lives. And I started laughing. Remember, Lynn?
Yeah, I do.
And he said, what are you laughing about, Bob? And I said, I'm laughing at you. And he said, well, why are you laughing at me? And I said, look, you just said that the whole world is just a matter of nothing, material forces operating one thing after another without any meaning or purpose at all, and that we, as human beings under Darwinism, are products of that meaningless, purposeless world and that meaningless, purposeless movement. And yet somehow we have to give meaning to this world. I said, where in the hell are we supposed to get this meaning from? If there's no meaning in the first place. I said, you can't get blood from a turnip, you know. I mean, you can't get blue from red. If there's no meaning, there's no meaning. You know, if the English language means anything at all. I said, so you can't give what you don't have.
And that's, and if there's no meaning, what difference does it make?
Exactly. And, you know, so why do you want meaning? In fact, how can you even want it if there isn't any? You know, and then where does it come from? It's like saying the world is orderly, and of course it is. But if the world is orderly, that word is a word that requires something to be an orderer. So where does this orderer come from? You know, how do we have an orderly world without an orderer? And the people can't answer those questions. And if we live as if there is no orderly world and there's no orderer and there's no meaning, take a look around you. Right now, take a look around you. And if you think that the world is falling apart, this is exactly why. Because we can't even find the law anymore. Because we don't have any meaning outside of material forces, and material forces are constantly relative. They're always contingent upon something else. You know, I mean, the leaf falls off the tree because the wind blew, and the wind blew because the sun shone on it, and the sun shone on it because there's atoms in the sun and so forth, and because it's moving through space, and on and on and on. There's no place to stand. Everything is relative to everything else, and there is nothing that you can actually find that is solid, absolute, and transcendent. When you get rid of God, you know, you were warned, you were told, you know, that you can do nothing without me. And we were warned even that our language would be confounded without God. That when people tried to build a tower to God on their own, in other words, meaning stepping away from God and being their own God, their language was confounded. It's called the Tower of Babel. And our language is being confounded today, is it not?
Right. What is the meaning of anything in language?
Exactly. Can we even define what a woman is anymore? Can we find out what pregnancy is? Can we define anything? We have people walking around that can't tell you what a rock is.
Well, they don't know that they're he's, she's, or it's.
Exactly. All right. And anyhow, a meaningless Darwinian world is simply not a place where a society with meaning and purpose and with a law and language that everybody can agree upon can exist. In short, in reply to the question, how are we to behave, the apparent answer now would be something like, to each his own. And isn't that exactly how we're behaving? Take a look at some of the streets in San Francisco or even in our own towns. The people are like zombies walking around, banging into walls and without any purpose or meaning or anything else. Their words slurred. Each individual bundle of nerve endings should do what seems best to him, her, it. And even now we can use the word him, her, it, they, them, whatever the particular pronoun they take on. But that answer given by everyone would lead to societal chaos, and hasn't it really? At least according to those sentient bundles who had thought things through. To prevent chaos, the modern Solons and Poobahs had to come up with a better answer to the question, which blind Darwinian science was unable to do. What the social contract theory allowed them to do And it is remarkable that they have pulled it off for as many centuries as they have, is to act as though the question had been answered. Of course, it hadn't. They just pretended that it had. And what it works out to practically is some form of utilitarianism. The greatest good for the greatest number, with good determined by our non-existent parliamentarians. This worked only so long as the residue of the previous Christian consensus allowed everyone to define good in ways that were at least recognizable to the different perspectives involved in the discussion. In other words, as long as there was still the money, you know, the credibility from Christianity in existence, this pretense that we had discovered a social contract theory could work because everybody could agree on what was good because it was left over from Christendom and left over from the foundation that the Catholic Church actually had established. The fact that social contract theory exists off the residue of Christendom forces us to look at all of this from another angle. The prodigal son did not run out of money his first weekend from home. He was enabled by his father's money to live in a way contrary to his father's values. The appropriation seemed to work just fine until his inheritance was spent and gone. In other words, when he went out to the bright lights and everything with a wallet, you know, fat with money, everything was just great. He walked into the tavern, slapped his money down, bought everybody a drink, bought himself a hamburger, and everything was just going fine, and people were all singing, well, he's a jolly good fellow. But when his money started to run out, things started to change. At some point, the tavern and the people in it were singing, those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end. You know, we'd laugh and drink and play forever in a day. You know, we'd fight and never lose. You know, my, oh my, those were the days. And that's exactly what happened. His father's money ran out, and it seems the same thing. Our credibility from Christianity that we've taken with us has run out. All of the agreements that we had on what language meant, what law meant, and what good meant, and what bad meant, and so forth, those worked for a while. Just by cultural lag, they stay in existence. But little by little, they were worn away. In other words, the money that we took with us from Christendom got spent. And when it got spent, we're taking a look right now at our society that is going bankrupt. There was a time when our secular establishment was able to buy drinks for the house and to proclaim that a common sense approach to the common good was all that we needed. But that was the Father's money talking. That was Christendom's credibility talking. Now that we have squandered the moral capital we inherited from Christendom, we're discovering just how radically distinct the different modern ethical systems can be. At the American founding, we were trying to navigate the differences between Presbyterians and Baptists, and at the outer edges, maybe Quakers. Now, we think it is possible to bridge the gap between gyrating drag queens at the children's story hour and conservative Mennonites. Some of us think that selling off the severed limbs of an unborn child is a constitutional right, while others think that our actual constitutional rights ought to be our constitutional rights. It is not possible to bridge the gulf between those viewpoints, especially not on the basis of a cooked-up 18th century mythical origin story. So, in other words, we're running out of our moral capital and our capital in general that we took with us from Christendom. And we have to remember that the whole foundation of Christendom was laid on the Catholic Church, which said all of us should be one. And Christ said it too. You all should be one. And instead, by the 16th century, and especially during the 18th century, we split up in Christianity, rather Christendom split up into thousands and thousands and thousands of different groups, all proclaiming that they were the right one. And with the Thomas Hobbes and the Enlightenment thinkers saying that we don't need religion at all, we don't need God at all. All we need is science and secularism, and that'll do the job. Take a look around us and see our civilization falling apart, everybody being a law and a freedom and an idea unto himself, and the actual real freedom falling away, being used up, and the people in the tavern are now down to the last dregs of their beer. And they're all sitting there singing, "Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end." But they're coming to an end, aren't they?
All right.
An old rhyme summarizes our dilemma quite well. If wishes were horses, beggars would ride. If turnips were watches, I'd wear one by my side. We cannot have a coherent political system simply because we have desperately wished for one. You can wish in one hand and spit in the other and see what you get. That's what my mother always told me. And we cannot fix that problem by imagining that our mythical ancestors had greater powers of imagination than we do. They did not, and we don't either. And if you want the proof of it, just take a look around you and see the mad, 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 mad world.
I can't think of a better example. Look around. It's here, my friend.
Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end. We'd laugh and dance and drink forever and a day. We'd fight and never lose. But take a look around and see what the real answer is. We'll go ahead and say our prayer. St. Michael the Archangel,
defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil.
May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, O Prince of the heavenly host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio.